The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You are listening to the Partially Examined Life, part 2 of episode 122 on Augustine on Mind and Metaphysics, covering his book, The Confessions, books 10 to 13. So last time we were talking about memory and the supposed paradoxes of memory. How can I remember?
The putative paradoxes?
That I can remember forgetfulness, for instance. So now the next part of book 10 is getting into the part that we referred to before, where the reality of the past and the future that he seems committed to, chapter 19, for instance. When the memory itself loses anything, as happens when we forget something and try to recall it, where are we to look for it, save in the memory? And if the memory chances to offer us something else instead, we reject it until we come upon the thing we are looking for. And when we come upon it, we say, this is it. But we could not say this unless we recognized it, and we could not recognize it unless we remembered it. Yet certainly we had forgotten it. So this is one of those paradoxes.
Yeah, so this is Meno's paradox. He sets this up in actually section 18. That's very obviously Meno's paradox. And so he gives us a tentative solution here. So trying to remember the name of a man whose name we have forgotten, he sort of gives us like an associative theory. Some other name occurs to us. We do not accept it because it was not our habit to think of that name with that man. We go on rejecting until the name occurs with which the mind is satisfied because it had been used to associating it with the man. So, but where does that name come back from except from memory? So we still have a problem. It has to be in there somewhere. This implies that there's at least, even when we've forgotten something, it's still within knowledge, or that there's the possibility of partial knowledge. He says it's not utterly forgotten.
The way it's presented there with a man whose name we used to know and now we've forgotten it. And it's a kind of weak form of Meno's paradox, where in that case it's actually closer to the learning of something we don't even remember knowing.
Yeah.
You know, the demonstration with the slave boy is showing him recollecting that the diagonal of a square is the square root of 2. And Socrates tries to pawn that off as recollecting. And that's much stronger of a claim than what Augustine seems to be making here, even if it's similar.
So then he moves on to remembering happiness.
Well, the beginning of 20, he makes a segue into happiness by reminding us that we're really looking for God. How then do I seek you, O Lord? For in seeking you, my God, it is happiness that I am seeking. I shall seek you that my soul may live, for my body lives by my soul, and my soul lives by you. What is the way to seek happiness then? Because I have no happiness till I can say, and say rightly, enough, it is there.
Right. So it turns out that desiring happiness requires, we have to have some knowledge of happiness.
Yeah, that makes the link back to memory, right? Is how do I recognize happiness? If I don't remember what happiness was, how do I recognize it? How do I get to God? Because I seek God in order to be happy, but in order to find happiness, I need to recognize what it is.
Right. Somewhere or other, they have come to know it. That is, they have some sort of knowledge of it. I strive to know whether or not this knowledge is in the memory, for if it is, then we have at some past time been happy. In section 21, it turns out happiness is, it's not in the memory in the way that other things are in the memory. It's not in the way that sense impressions are. It's not even in the way in the memory in the way numbers and a priori things are, or eloquence, you know, skill-based sorts of procedural memories. And then he gets into a section where he's going to talk about happiness isn't the memory in the same way that joy is. So he ended up with talking about, but where and when I had any experience of happiness, that I should remember it and love it and long for it, and that everyone else does as well. Basically, I just have to have experienced happiness in the past.
This is the end of chapter 21 here. All agree that they desire happiness, just as they would agree if they were asked that they desire joy. And indeed, they think joy and happiness are the same thing. One man may get it one way, another, yet all are alike in striving to attain this one thing, namely that they may be joyful. It is something that no one can say that he has had no experience of, which is why he finds it in his memory and recognizes it when he hears the word happiness.
In section 22, he realizes that happiness is joy in God, and not some people have joy in vices. So it turns out that not everyone really does desire happiness if we define happiness as joy in God. Then he goes on to say, well, if it's joy in God, it's also joy in the truth. And everyone desires joy in the truth, because in the sense that everyone desires not to be deceived. It's not entirely uncomplicated, because we might wish to deceive people, but at the very least, we wish not to be deceived. So he's taking the joy in truth as a universal thing. And then, so the question is why we fail in being happy if the joy in truth is what happiness is. And the answer is that people are distracted from the truth because he says they remember truth so slightly. And the thing that interferes with our remembering of the truth is that we love other stuff. And this is where I started to think about Nietzsche and his stuff on truth. But when the truth conflicts with something else we love, something else we want, then we hate the truth. So even though the truth is, it should be the source of our happiness, the joy in truth, it's conflicts with other, you know, with our concupiscence, with our desires, because the truth would reveal us, it would show us to be sinful. We hate the truth. So there's this interesting paradox that even thus, does the human mind, blind and inert, vile and ill-behaved, desire to keep itself concealed, yet desire that nothing should be concealed from itself? So this whole desire for truth becomes sort of asymmetrical. We want to uncover other things, but conceal our own wretchedness from ourselves and others so that we can keep pursuing our lusts.
They hate the truth for the sake of that other thing which they love because they take it for truth.
Oh, well, that's a little bit different than what I said.
But it's in the same section. They love the truth when it enlightens them. They hate truth when it accuses them.
My interpretation of that, so truth is loved in such a way that those who love some other thing want it to be the truth. So this other thing I took to be any other thing we desire. You know, we want it to be the truth in the sense that we want it to come to be. Or we want it to be the right thing. So even if it's gluttony or if it's lust, we'd rather ignore the truth of the wretchedness of that situation, because our desire overwhelms us so much. And so we treat it almost as if it is the truth.
But what about the last two sentences? Even so, for all its worthlessness, the human mind would rather find its joy in truth and falsehood, so that it shall be happy if, with no other thing to distract, it shall one day come to rejoice in that sole truth by which all things are true. So that even with that desire to ignore true things or deceive itself, ultimately, the human mind is still understands what the truth is and is sensitive to that and would rather have it than not. Which seems to be just a straight up claim that he's making. Mainly because the truth comes through God.
Yeah.
Right. So this seems to be just another restatement or a grappling with a Platonic problem. Plato's saying that everybody tends toward what they take to be the good.
Yeah.
So we can get insight here into Ava's claim that Augustine was so different from Plato and Aristotle because those guys said, well, once you recognize something for the good, that's what you go toward. But of course, you know, there's things in the Nicomachean Ethics about akrasia, about why do we not pursue what we know to be good? Weakness of the will.
As yeah, incontinence. Akrasia.
And so how is this different?
Her claim is that Augustine presents us with the active willing of evil, as opposed to mere incontinence. In fact, that the will is primarily distinguished by being against God's will, and therefore the willing of evil is its distinguishing feature. That's how we recognize that there is a will, is that we go against God.
Okay, well, so let's try to see how that thing that we learn from other parts of the Confessions and from Ava is reflected here, because it's not super obvious. I mean, it's interesting that we're in the middle of a book that's supposed to be about memory, about epistemology. But of course, for Plato, that's very closely related to ethics. And so that's what I'm trying to get at here is he's making a very Platonic sounding claim that everybody wants happiness. And the difference is that different people take different things to be happiness. Initially, the thing that I had taken the note is that people reject the truth in favor of what they take to be truth. And that sounds like it's what they see to be truth, what they think that truth really is. It sounds like they're making a mistake, and maybe that's true. But then when Wes read more, read the sentences just before that, this is a few sentences earlier, simply because truth is loved in such a way that those who love some other thing want it to be the truth.
And then thus they hate the truth for the sake of the other thing, which they love because yeah. They take it for the truth. which I think could just be a simple saying as being Thrasymachus, you know, or one of those other Platonic characters who says, of course, having power and money and pleasure is the good.
But this is different than what he talks about with what happens to him with the pears that he steals.
But is it? I think because it's willful taking here.
Well, he makes the distinction. He says that it's not that he thought that stealing the pears was good and that he wanted to do it because it was good and true. He wanted to do it because of the evilness of it. He wanted to do it because it was wrong. That's an added distinction from what he's talking about here. Here he's talking about being in love with something and saying that it's true because we love true things. And so we take things to be good, even though we're wrong about that. So you're right, Mark, that that is a kind of Platonic understanding that if we take something that's actually bad for us to be the good, because we're always inclined towards the good, we're just making a mistake about how we understand the good. But earlier, he makes a different distinction about our kinds of activities that we can have, in which we actually purposefully do things that are evil for the sake of them being evil, which is different than what he's talking about here. Here, you're doing something that's wrong, but for the sake of you believing or at least convincing yourself that it's good.
Right. The convincing itself. I think that Augustine is trying to say that we're responsible for our own mistakes, that sort of God gives us the light of reason and such, so that we always have the opportunity. We're never really honestly self-deceived, right? We're always the ones doing the deceiving.
Sure.
And being wrong about anything, since all general truths are a matter of consulting the inner Jesus, whenever we hold any wrong doctrine about anything, it's because we are ignoring the inner Jesus and we are cleaving to something else. If he was thinking, he was so long caught by the idea that God must be some kind of body, because he was clinging to the idea of body in general. He was a body kind of guy. He was a lascivious individual.
In general, the thing we cling to is depending on ourselves instead of depending on God, treating ourselves as omnipotent. That's his whole explanation of why it is that we would just do something evil for the sake of it being evil. Well, it's because the transgression part of that makes us feel free and unbounded by God's laws and all of that stuff. We are our own lawgivers and we have that freedom and ultimately that sense of omnipotence. Here, I take his account to have something to do with falling into heteronomy, falling into lust and desire, and rationalizing it with the idea that it's the good or the true. But, you know, the other part of heteronomy also is that the whole problem with lust for Augustine is that it separates us from God. It makes us think that those corporeal, material things are enough. So we sort of, instead of depending on God, we think we can depend on them, even though they are becoming, they pass away, so on and so forth. So I'm trying to get at the sense in which these explanations are related, but they're both a sense in which we turn away from having to depend on God to something which is freer, you know, whether it's pursuing your own lusts or doing something, the transgression, simply for the sake of proving that you're free. So I'm saying the akrasia, yeah, explanation, I'm saying there's a sense in which they can be reconciled with the willful transgression explanation.
Yes.
Yeah, but the akrasia explanation, that kind of Aristotelian incontinence, seems to me to be completely different. This seems to be much, much more Platonic.
Let me explain again what I mean.
I thought I understood what you were saying.
Okay.
In that, in this section, he's pointing to the way in which we categorize something that is bad as good in order to justify our inclination towards it. And that we either make an honest mistake about it or we, you know, make a dishonest mistake about it.
What's the problem with lust? Why can't we just screw and eat and do whatever we want?
Because it is too enticing. It pulls us too wholeheartedly and away from God.
Because we can't depend on those things in the way we depend on God. They're fleeting. They're passing. Mm-hmm. They're not ontologically foundational enough for our,
they're not true,
for our souls. Yeah, they're not true. Even though from a psychological perspective, it's not like I overeat and or I pursue my lusts because I want to transgress against God. But it has that same effect of separating me from God. When I'm doing the pear garden thing, it's for the feeling of omnipotence. It certainly is different than simply pursuing pleasure. But they're not unrelated things in the sense that the one is an attempt to free myself from the tyranny of God. The other is primarily for the sake of pleasure, but does have that effect of separating me and freeing me from God, I would be surprised if that weren't part of the psychological motivation. So this is what Lacan calls jouissance, right? Doing things for pleasure, especially if we're overeating and we're actually ultimately making ourselves sick and doing things like that, that's the jouissance part of it. There's that transgressive element, which is there as well, even in the akrasia explanation. So I agree with the distinction. I thought Mark was trying to get us to grapple with those two different strains in Augustine. I had actually been thinking quite a bit about this.
I've previously been following Ava's lead and interpreting all these mistakes as pernicious, as rebellious. But now I think that maybe Ava overstates the willfulness. What is implied by willfulness in the way that we discussed it on the episode with her is seeing an authority and saying, screw you, authority, I'm doing the opposite of this. But even in the case with the pears, he was not thinking about, oh, that God is a tyrant over me, I'm going to reject God and do this own thing. Like, it was not spitting in the face of authority in the way that a 2-year-old grabs her sandwich and is willful and confronts the other and says, screw you, to the other. That it's more like the Platonic mistake where you take something to be good. So in this case, in the case of the pears, I take this to be an assertion of my autonomy and that feels good or something. And it's just that there's something mistaken about that. Instead of interpreting all this as assholish and extra willful, I think we should interpret it more as mistaken.
No, I completely disagree with you, Mark. I think that both things are going on. This kind of mistakenness is going on in the section that we're focusing on right now. But I think that Augustine is utterly clear that the act with the pear is a willful act of loving the thing and the sin itself. It's not a misunderstanding of what his good is, the way Augustine understands it. He doesn't think of it as, well, I thought that stealing the pears was good and it was fun, but I misunderstood that.
Right, because he's giving a post hoc analysis of his action. He's saying, after the fact, what I was really doing is rebelling against God. But the way he describes it is he...
No, he doesn't say rebelling against God. He's saying that he's in love with the sin. Now, you can go from there to say that that was an act of rebelling against God. But the important thing about that section is that he's saying that he's doing evil for evil's sake, which is very different than being incontinent with respect to the good, which is Aristotle, or misunderstanding what the good is, which is Plato. So in the section that we're reading right now, in section book 10, there it's very Platonic. I misunderstand what the good is, and I don't do it because I'm inclined to the good, because everything's inclined to the good, but I happen to misunderstand what the good is. Then you have something like Aristotle, which is, I know what the good is, but I can't get myself to do it. I'm incontinent with respect to it. I try to do it. I reach for it, but I fail. And then you have the section on the pear, whereas I purposefully do the evil thing, the thing that I know is wrong. I actually embrace it and do it for its own sake. And that's a third different thing.
I think Mark knows that that's Augustine's argument, right?
Yeah.
But he's saying he doesn't buy it.
I'm saying that throughout here, I think Augustine tries to equivocate those kind of things. That really, even if you think you are making a mistake, you are being willful. Even if you think you are having just a weakness of will, you want to do the good, but that it's really, it amounts to the same phenomena as being willful. And what I'm worried about is, how do we characterize that? You're saying, oh no, those are very different things. There's the Augustinian pear example, and there's the Aristotle thing. I'm saying he really tries to mush them all together. So in my mind, I'm trying to figure out how to characterize this single mushed together thing. According to Augustine, straight up, I think, you know, the way I've been saying it before is, we are responsible for our intellectual mistakes. It is both willful and it is mistaken. Well, I don't think that's a tenable argument. So I think you could account for all the stuff that Augustine is trying to account for, including the pear example, by really the way that West just characterized the pear example, pursuing what you think, you're not thinking very much at all, but pursuing what you take at that moment to be the good.
But do you think that that's what Augustine is saying? Or do you think that that's a way to rationalize Augustine to make himself consistent, or to make all of these things part of one thing? Because yes, maybe you can come up with another way of understanding all of these examples that comes under one version of it.
What I want to distinguish is between the post hoc analysis of it as being willful and how you actually feel about it at the time. And he doesn't really believe that because he thinks that if you make a mistake, you're really self-deceiving yourself. You really on some level know you're deceiving yourself. And so you're really being a willful bastard. That's his analysis.
So can't we admit that sometimes we do things for the sake of pleasure and sometimes it's will to power? The willfulness thing is a will to power. I'm doing things for the feeling of omnipotence.
I think you're softening the way Augustine is understanding.
Well, I'm relying on his explanation where he essentially says, you want to be omnipotent like God. And I admit I may be stretching it when I associate it with will to power. So let's leave that part aside.
No, but I think you're onto something just because it's a positive. That even if you say I'm pursuing power, that's a positive thing, which is different than I just do it because it's wicked, which sounds purely negative.
Right. And we talked about this in the first episode where he initially says, yes, I'm doing it because it's evil. But then he gives a very acute, interesting psychological explanation of this where he wants to explain it in terms of us going after this feeling of omnipotence. And again, trying to be gods unto ourselves, which is one of his recurring themes. And even Nietzsche, right? Nietzsche makes fun of the English philosophers for trying to reduce all human motivation to pleasure when he sees this whole will to power thing as a much more fundamental force. But that doesn't mean that we don't sometimes do things simply for pleasure. Psychologically, the Pear Garden situation is quite different from me simply being a glutton. Although, as I just said before, I think there's the jouissance will to power element, even in that pure case of gluttony. And the other thing I just wanted to say is I also think there's a strong sense in which the Platonic theory of no man knowingly does evil can be reconciled with the willfulness theory. And that's the sense in which the putting yourself in the omnipotent position actually is related. It is an attempt to regain the moral order for yourself or to sort of re-establish the moral order. I've mentioned this guy Jack Katz before in The Seductions of Crime, and there's actually another book out called Virtuous Violence. There's a lot of this sociology done on when people commit violence. I mean, and this is just really, I mean, I think the sociology has shown this very well. They usually are in a self-righteous state of mind. Even when they're doing things that don't obviously look like they're of moral import, violence is hyper-moral. So even if you think to yourself, oh, I'm doing this because I'm an evil bastard and I just like to fucking torture and murder people, there's actually a way to understand that as a sort of hyper-moralism in which my evil is sanctified by the shitty treatment I received as a child because everyone else sucks and I should be able to do this to other people. So that kind of thinking. So I think there's an interesting way in which all these explanations, they're not as simply cut and dried and distinct as they seem to be at first blush.
I think part of it depends on A, how seriously you take Augustine as speaking of doing evil for evil's sake, and B, whether you think that he's right about that or not. It may be that he's simply wrong. So in your articulation of those interesting ways in which they're linked, Wes, one of the ways I would read that is that Augustine is simply wrong about the notion of doing evil for evil's sake.
No, I don't think he is. I think he's correct psychologically. Once you've explained evil for evil's sake, I think if you stop there, you leave it as sort of an opaque mystery of what that means. What does it mean to want to do evil for evil's sake? You have to get deeper into the psychology. And once you get to the point of trying to inhabit a position of omniscience or power, then you're, I mean, I think he's exactly right about that. And he explicitly says that. And then that links up with some of the other stuff. So,
yes, but when you gloss it as will to power or omnipotence, that's very transparently another version of we do things because they're good for us.
Because we take them to be good for us, yeah.
And that's not taking seriously the notion that we're doing things that are bad for bad's sake. And that's fine. To me, that just means that Augustine would be interpreted as being fundamentally wrong in this respect of understanding the psychology of doing bad things or things that are bad for us or doing wrong things. That it could be more Platonic, like we're just misunderstand it, or it could be a will to power, which is very close to that same kind of idea, it seems to me.
Well, he's right to the extent that someone might, psychologically he's right, someone might be telling themselves they're doing an evil thing because it's evil. Like a Graham Greene character whose Catholicism has ruined them and turned them into someone who's attracted to evil. But I think at a deeper level, I'm challenging the notion And I think Augustine sows the seeds that undermine that explanation when he gets into that whole omnipotence and power stuff.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the case.
Well, and maybe it's the case that all these are on a spectrum. It's just that the way Ava was characterizing it, Augustine's legacy, according to her, is that the pair example is the paradigm case of willing. So that really, whenever you make a mistake, it's, whenever you engage in a self-deception, whenever you cleave to something instead of God, that you're saying, fuck you, God. That's what's really going on. Whereas maybe Augustine's real picture is that in the extreme case, you're actually saying, yes, I'm doing this for wickedness' sake. But in the vast majority of cases, even though I still think it's wrong, even though it's against God, you do actually think you're doing the right thing. You're not trying to be willful against God. You don't even have God on your radar. You're just trying to pursue what you're trying to pursue, whether, and you can call it will to power or call it any number of other needs and desires, but you don't have as part of your fundamental psychological makeup the idea that there's a giant, I don't know. Now I'm convincing myself the other way, that he has the Kierkegaard picture of, as soon as you let yourself glance a little bit, you see that there's a giant God looming there. And so anything you do is going to be colored either paying attention to that or willfully turning away from that. That's just Augustine's picture.
And I think the God thing is actually fundamental, because look at what happens to schizophrenics. The omnipotence thing often has a manifestation of them having delusions that they are God or Jesus or something like that. Even if you're not religious, it's a psychological schema of some sort, I think. The omnipotent being that I potentially might be, the one who depends on no one, who can meet all his own needs, who will never lose anything. That's the psychological schema at work. So,
but is this relevant to how he's talking a little later about, despite all my enlightenment, I still, when I come upon a spider in a web eating a fly, I'm absorbed by that. And can we really characterize that, or do we want to characterize that as, well, that's just a mild version of the same thing that was going on with the pears? There has to be something that's simply ignoring God and not saying, screw you, God.
Again, Mark, I think that there is that ignoring God part going on. I don't think that means that saying screw you, God is just another degree of ignoring God. I at least see both of those things going on.
Yeah, I think we would say at least, yes, we do things for pleasure.
Without being willful, that's the point.
Without being willful, but although later on Augustine frets about the perils of pleasure. Because like I said, even if it's not willful in its intent, it still has that effect of separating us from God, according to Augustine.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I think implied in there is that it's easy to slide from the pleasure mode to something that goes into jouissance mode, where we actively are trying to separate ourselves from God. Those two things are never so easily distinct. And that's what Augustine worries about in the later books. So it's the idea that, for instance, I might be eating the soup 1 minute for the basic pleasure it provides, but then I might get sucked into a fantasy of nothing else in the world matters, and this is all I need. That something that feeds my little omnipotent fantasy. I think that's the sinful danger of any basic pleasure, which is why Augustine is so worried about even hearing music, like any pleasure he's worried about.
Yeah. And this is where he sort of goes off the rails.
Right? Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
At least to me, he does. That the body becomes a deep problem, that any kind of experience of pleasure becomes a fast train to hell away from God. And he's wringing his hands in those sections about how he needs to, it's not even discipline himself. He needs to deprive himself in order to constantly keep himself close to God for fear of falling away from God. And what I find disturbing and confusing about those sections is the relying on God part is utterly vacuous of cause or motion or way in which it's going to work. It's that I'm going to deprive myself because if I don't do so, I find myself falling away from God. It involves so little activity to rightly orient yourself in any kind of positive way that everything you're doing is negative at that point. It's very, very far away from some kind of virtue ethics or idea of understanding a balanced soul. It's literally understanding you as being kind of depriving your soul in order to maintain a closeness with God. It's like gripping a hold of the side of a mountain where you imagine you're always on a tiny, tiny ledge.
So I'm glad you brought this back to teleology.
Wait, where in that was teleology?
If you focus on the willfulness, then you're focusing on our sinful nature. And you're saying our teleology is to fall away from God, is to get sucked into anything that comes along. And that's really what willfulness is all about, is by asserting me and my particular connection to these created things and these other temporary things, and asserting my own temporariness and asserting that it is in fact eternal, that I am God, all this stuff, that that's what human nature is.
I'm not sure that I agree that he completely understands the falling away from God as being completely willful.
All right, well, we can talk about that more in just a minute after we talk about our sponsor. This episode is made possible by sponsorship from The Great Courses, offering engaging video and audio lectures taught by top experts, including many, many philosophy courses. And this time, I dove into Philosophy of Mind, Brains, Consciousness, and Thinking Machines by Professor Patrick Grimm. I've gotten through about the first 6 lectures so far. And if, like many of our listeners, you're dissatisfied by the fact that we've really only had 1 episode on Philosophy of Mind, then this much more leisurely paced, detailed, actually prepared presentation really hits the mark. It was getting into the rationale for Cartesian dualism, and then the many positions trying to respond to or replace that. And not only does he have clear presentations with lots of examples, but he'll bring in cool historical tidbits. Just his presentation of phrenology, the theory that bumps on the skull show you aspects of a person's personality, and of course, how that's a pseudoscience, but actually how it relates to a legitimate controversy at the time about whether the brain's functioning was localized or whether all the different parts of the brain basically did the same thing. The idea being that phrenology sort of discredited by its bullshittiness, the idea that the different parts of the brain were function specific, and so that went out of fashion, but that's actually what ended up being true. So whether you're just starting with philosophy, you don't know much about Philosophy of Mind, is a great place to start, or you could just skip right to the later lectures on machine intelligence, higher order thoughts. He brings in some cutting edge science and considerations from other disciplines. Very helpful, definitely good to supplement the more informal presentation we have on this podcast with something formal like this. So The Great Courses is celebrating their 25th anniversary. They've got over 500 courses, not only in philosophy, but history, religion, and more. They're available in DVDs, CDs, streaming, digital downloads, or with The Great Courses apps. For a limited time, The Great Courses has a special offer for all our listeners. You can order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including this Philosophy of Mind one, at up to 80% off the original price. To take advantage of this offer, go to thegreatcourses.com/PEL. That's thegreatcourses.com/PEL.
Hey everyone, Nathan Hanks here with your weekly update from the Partially Examined Life's Not School. We're heading into September now, and there's lots for members to get involved with over in the Citizens Forum. There are some proposed groups looking for members on Anatheism, Returning to God After God by Richard Kearney, The Irony of American History by Reinhold Niebuhr, Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant, The Philosophical Canon, and Irony with Suggested Readings. There are also confirmed groups going to discuss The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley on September 13th, Frankenstein by Mary Shelley September 20th, and Identity and Hegemony by Ernesto Laclau later in September. Now, if you heard all those groups and can't find that special one, consider proposing one yourself. Listeners can find out more about Not School and becoming a PEL citizen at partiallyexaminedlife.com. If you have any questions, email me. That's Nathan, partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thanks for listening and happy reading.
We're talking about these final sections in Book 10, right? Where he's worried about food and all the other pleasures.
Yeah.
Yes, but then I forget exactly where this is. Maybe this is getting into even Book 13 stuff that we're not going to explicitly talk about. But he seems to think once we're away from those distractions, once we can neutralize, then we are at peace in God. And this is why I was trying to hook it up to Plato. Everybody tries to do what they think to be good. Everybody is attracted toward the good. Is I think that Augustine's picture is twofold, that half of it is that original sin thing. But then the other part is that we are not in the absence of sin, like we're just hanging onto a mountain and any sin can come along and pull us down. It is true that as a matter of day-to-day living, even if he talks about even, you know, he's calmed him, his lusts, but he still, when he is asleep, will have lustful dreams. Like they're just always freaking something. And it's only in death when I will be at one with God and be truly at rest But still, we have deep within our memory, beyond the parts that anything through the senses could ever reach, in the part that becomes equivalent with remembering the truth that is God, is our true center, is our true still point. And this reminded me of Spinoza's take on immortality, that he says, so far as we are reasonable beings, then we are in essence one with the absolute, with the whole. So like basically we are God. So if you were very reasonable throughout your life and avoided the things of the flesh and just really getting all worked up over stuff, if we were creatures of stillness, then even though our individual body dies, it's like we are still living on because we live on in the universal that persists. And you can kind of see where Augustine, where we get a lot of that, that we have a God nature, I don't want to say in us, but the root to it is through our inside. As we reach into the storehouse of memory, and well, certainly God couldn't fit in the storehouse of memory. My own mind can't even fit in my own mind. So it must be a root to some metaphysically larger thing, to God itself. And that is ultimately where our teleology wants to pull it. If only we can shake free of sin.
So he explains why we need continence. This is in chapter 29 of book 10. Because I just want to say this for people who think that it's sort of some sort of arbitrary prudishness. I don't think it is, even though it's insufferable to sit through these chapters of him worrying about all this stuff. So he says near the beginning of chapter 29, "For by continence we are collected and bound up into a unity within ourself, whereas we had been scattered abroad in a multiplicity." So this is getting back to when I asked the question about, well, what's wrong with just giving in to all our lusts? And I talked about the lack of their dependability. And that has implications for the unity of ourselves. So there's an explanation here. In other words, our integrity depends upon our continence. And our integrity is related to this relationship to God. So our relationship to God is the way we stay whole and actualized and all those other good things you might see in Aristotelian virtue ethics. It's not like the basic explanation is, well, I must have God and the pleasures separate me from God. There's a deeper explanation here where of why God is good for us and continence is good for us.
Yeah, and I think this relates to the thing about temporality, in that insofar as we are creatures that exist over time, we are composed of separate moments. We're divided amongst ourselves. Right. And if we are incontinent, that means we are now getting swept up by one momentary pleasure and now another momentary pleasure. And now we're swept up by the fights and whatever the thing is. Whereas if we achieve a point of stillness where we are just oriented toward God and soaking everything up from God, then, well, God's voice ultimately speaks to us from beyond time. We become more like atemporal creatures. Again, we can't actually take the step until we die and enter that atemporal realm. And he actually has quite a bit in book 12 or 13 about the difference between the created heaven, which is atemporal, but still it's a created thing. It's not co-eternal with God and God himself. So there's room in the cosmology for us to be in touch with the atemporal realm without necessarily becoming God. It's not like Spinoza, where see the God in yourself, or any kind of Eastern mysticism where that's the ultimate point. Augustine's not going to be down with anything where God is deep with inside you in a literal way. It's that if you go deep enough inside you, you are just encounter a realm that is completely not you, because it's not finite the way you are. It sounds like a matter of semantics, and that's something that I wrote about a long time ago in undergrad, about mysticism, about the different kinds of mysticism. Like you could have a kind of mysticism where the point is to grow yourself, like the you are God, I'm God, we're all God, we're all one. And so that the idea is to then identify yourself with the whole by sort of growing your ego such that it fills the whole thing, even though it becomes not a personal ego anymore, obviously. And then what happens if you instead, as Augustine is recommending, basically shrink everything about you that's individual, so that you just are then all the things from day to day that are my concerns, just let them drop away. Those are not important. Basically snuff yourself out as an individual. And then that's the backdoor entrance to the eternal, the one, your oneness. So the end result is actually the very same freaking thing, but it's a completely opposite attitude towards the self. Are you trying to grow it? Or are you trying to shrink it? And Christians are in the shrink camp.
Right.
Can we talk about time yet? Can we be done with book 10? We got to talk a little bit about book 11.
Well, yeah, I thought we'd already talked about time.
Yeah, so did I. I thought we were done.
All right, what else do you have to say?
It's the end of time.
It's the end of our time.
I thought I remembered that the section on memory led directly into the section on time, but instead it leads into the second half of book 10 that we've been talking about, which is all this fretting about, I'm pretty good, but I still have a lot of sins left.
Yeah.
I still have nocturnal emissions or whatever he's worried about.
Love of praise. He does like to be praised. He's tempted by flattery.
Food, music, art, anything beautiful, you know, gossip, curiosity, all of those things. Freak shows.
Side boob.
Side boob.
It would be better for my own good if I could just do good things and not get praised for it. Because when I get praised for it, I start caring more about the praise than actually doing the good thing. But on the other side, the command of justice is that you praise people for doing good things and you condemn them for doing bad things. So I can't tell my fellows, please don't praise me anymore for my good things. Like, because that would be telling them to do the wrong thing. So there's these sort of practical contradictions in trying to be as perfect can be. Which I think it's easy to dismiss Augustine as naive on this or that. Like he's completely one-dimensional about sexuality or whatever. But when you look at how much he agonizes over these things, the agonizing is also a matter of intellectual agonizing. So he really is not capable of being naive about anything. That he considers these practical contradictions of like being a saint. And though we might say, well, if wanting praise is a bad thing, but yet justice commands that people actually continue to praise you, so that's always going to be there, then maybe there's something wrong with your aversion to praise in the first place. That might be the way we would react to that. But just like all these things, you know, he raises these apparent contradictions in the concept of creation or God himself. Like, it's not on the table to throw out the divine commandment. Like, the hermeneutic task here is to see how these apparently contradictory things are in fact harmonious. Even if that means saying, well, we just can't fully understand how they're harmonious. We can't fully understand the Trinity. We can't fully understand how there could be no time before time or these many other things like this. But he never says, as people do now, but you just have to take it on faith. You just have to go with it.
Right.
He never actually is at the point of saying you have to intellectually cop out. I'm ever grasping to get more of an intellectual handle on this because God gave me my reason to do so.
Yeah, but to go back to sort of question mark you raised at the beginning, Mark, about it being often doctrinaire, is while he's trying to sort through some things, it's always seemingly in terms of, I don't know if it was doctrinaire at the time or not, or if it just feels doctrinaire now, looking back on Augustine, right? But the characteristics of God and the questions that he's answering seem to always come down to what feel like doctrinaire answers. And that might be fine. As you point out, it's a hermeneutical task.
Right. The thing that I'm trying to grasp with here in dealing with Augustine is that the usual way that I, as a non-religious person, think of religious people. While I was an undergrad taking classes, and I would run in occasionally to somebody who was also a philosophy major, but who was super religious. And this was always very puzzling to me. And the way that I interpreted it is, well, there's a point in which they stop thinking. And I think Augustine is a good argument against that interpretation of a thoughtful religious person. There is not a point in which they stop thinking. It's just that, well, what is the alternative? That there's a framework in which they have to think. That's kind of the way we're set. Well, you know, we're taking the Bible as given and I can think all I want so long as I don't go beyond that, those bounds. I mean, that still sounds like there's bounds beyond which they stop thinking, but that's not how it feels when you read Augustine.
I mean, if you're treating the Bible as something to be interpreted non-literally, let's say, then yeah, then it's not as much of a, then it really isn't a boundary on thinking.
Yeah.
It's a, and it becomes more of a springboard for thinking.
But you still have the logical demands of consistency and stuff. And that's where, to me, it feels like the rationality of Augustine sort of rings through in that, as he articulates with his problems with the Manichaeans and why he ultimately falls away from them, there's a lack of intellectual integrity regarding the way in which they think about the world, that he finds a higher level of intellectual integrity in the Catholic way at his time about reconciling how you understand God and how you answer these paradoxes, these seeming paradoxes that are resolved in a satisfactory way.
All right, so let's talk about time in terms of that. And this is not the way he puts it, but you could sort of think of it in terms of Kant's antinomies, that does time have a beginning or not? That it seems that if it just went on forever, there's just something that boggles our mind about that. We can't make sense of that. So it must have had a beginning, but then it can't, according to the Kantian argument, it can neither go on infinitely, nor can it have a beginning. Neither of those sort of make sense to us. And so Augustine's, you know, the theological way around that is to, as we were saying before, to say God created time and what creation means, and then go on to figure out what creation means, because it can't be, and this is came up in Dawkins or something, that like, well, to create anything, if I create a watch, well, it's, I have hands, I have tools, there are parts of me that address parts of the watch, and we put them together. Well, that can't be the way creation happens. It has to happen all at once. The word of God is what creates it. Well, then, and it doesn't even make sense to ask what happened before the word, because the word is the creation, and yet you can still talk about logical priorities. You can say that God created forms out of formless matter, even though the formless matter did not exist prior to it getting a form. The formed matter is sort of logically subsequent to the formless matter, but chronologically, they both happened at the same time. So it could be that these are just ways of putting together words that make the puzzles supposedly less glaring. They let your mind rest at ease by just bamboozling you with a bunch of words like eternity and co-eternal, the thing that I just said about formless matter. But at least it sounds impressive enough that it doesn't feel like, I could see Augustine's point of view that he doesn't think he's stopped thinking.
I mean, the time stuff is part of his hermeneutical exercise about understanding what God is. And the whole end of the book for several chapters is him going through that exercise, the beginning of which in 11 is, why is he writing? He's meditating on God's law. And then he gets to this point where you said about God speaking his word, which takes you immediately to what happened in the beginning. And so that directly leads to the discussion of time. And so it's part of the hermeneutical exercise of understanding what God is speaking to us after having understood how another connection we have to God, which is via our memory and our minds.
So we have to read some of these quotes about time because we've built it up too much. Is this, I think it's by the chapter 11, maybe?
Book 11, chapter 15.
I've got some stuff before that in chapter 11 at least, but I'm not sure exactly which. The best quotes.
Book 11 is about God's atemporality in his creating of time. I mean, chapter 11 of book 11.
Right. So book 12, what I come now to answer the man who says, what was God doing before he made heaven and earth? I do not give the jesting answer, said to have been given by one who sought to evade the force of the question. He was getting hell ready for people who pry too deep. To poke fun at a questioner is not to see the answer. My reply will be different. I would rather say that I don't know when I don't, then hold up one to ridicule who has a profound question and win applause for a worthless answer. That was all a digression, but it was a fun enough one that it's worth reading. But oh my God, I say that you are the creator of all creation, and if by the phrase heaven and earth we mean all creation, then I make bold to reply, before God made heaven and earth, he did not make anything. For if he had made something, what would it have been but a creature? And I wish I knew all that it would have been profitable for me to know, as well as I know that no creature was made before any creature was made. Well, that's not talking about the phenomenology of time yet. When do we actually get to that? That's on chapter 15?
Yeah. He's really talking about God is not – he wasn't doing anything before time because there is no before time. for God. There's no, in his atemporal world, there's no before and after. So then chapter 14, he asks the question of what is time then? And then we get into the, well, it's really chapter, towards the end of chapter 14 where he gets into the phenomenology. But the two times, past and future, how can they be, since the past is no more and the future is not yet? On the other hand, if the present were always present and never flowed away into the past, it would not be time at all, but eternity.
Even the present, the next sentence, but if the present is only time because it flows away from the past, how can we say that it is? For it is only because it will cease to be.
Right. And then he gets us to say what the present is, which it turns out to be an indivisible moment with no duration. So near the end, if we conceive of some point of time which cannot be divided to even the minutest parts of moments, that is the only point that we can call the present. If there's anything longer than something with no part, then you can divide it up into past, present, and future, right?
So the present is now.
Right. But it's of no duration. And so that point flees at such lightning speed from being future to being past that it has no extent of duration at all. For if it were so extended, it would be divisible, blah, blah, blah. I found that very fascinating.
So it seems like he doesn't give an argument there for the past not existing and the future not existing.
I'm willing to grant that the past doesn't currently exist.
Well, the past and future don't exist in the sense that they're not now.
Yeah, Napoleon does not exist.
Yeah.
I don't. Is there an argument needed for that?
Okay, well, so you agree with him flushing by it.
My great-grandchild doesn't exist. Yeah.
I've read too many books and seen too many movies about time travel that it's easy for me to picture time as being like a timeline that is written on a piece of paper and that all the past and present actually do exist in a sense right now, though not in a temporal sense, but they coexist as if time was a dimension that one could pass back and forth as one goes left and right.
I think Augustine agrees from the God's eye view, right? That's the way it looks. There is no time for God, and that metaphor works. It's all just, you know, you could think of time as almost spatial in that sense, which is the way they often try and represent those.
But it wouldn't even be spatial because God is everywhere at once. So it's more the sense of all at once than time is frozen.
Just trying to get the metaphor of how it would seem to God. All presence exists at once for God. But for us, that's not the case. For God, there isn't even a present because he's outside of it. You'd have to use a different word. If you want to be strict about what we mean by the word present, present is used metaphorically in those other cases.
Well, what about the word is? I guess that's the question. Because we think, as you guys so readily admit, that the past and future don't really exist, that they don't is, they are not, to be grammatically correct, then he wants to say that they lack being in a metaphysical sense.
Yeah.
And that completely goes together with all we've been saying all along, that everything that's not God is, because it's finite, lacks being in some way. But you could say a finite thing at the point that it existed had being right then. But that's not supposedly how being works. Being has to be something that is persistent. Is there an argument for that, or how does that relate to this point here?
I don't know what you're asking.
He's asking, doesn't Augustine mean that things don't really have being unless they're eternal? And therefore, God is the only thing that really has being. And all things that are generated, live, and cease to be don't really have being because they aren't eternal. And isn't that what Augustine is saying?
So I know Augustine believes that. He makes it very clear. But is he in this section where he's talking about the past doesn't exist, the future doesn't exist, the present only exists insofar as it fading into the past, insofar as it is becoming non-being? Is he trying to argue for that picture that God is infinite and everything else is not? Or is it underlying the phenomenology here? Is he already come to that conclusion and that's just determining his choice of words here? Which is the chain of justification?
I mean, I just thought he was trying to understand time, and that to the extent that it brought along with it, understanding being is the only place where you had being or existence was in the present. As was pointed out, that manifestly, the past and the future don't have existence. That is, they don't have being at all.
But I guess since the present is so short, you don't even really have being in the present. There is no being as far as finite humans are concerned. I think that is what the ultimate conclusion of this. I'm just trying to determine, is that actually a good argument? Or did you not see that as what he was arguing for ultimately?
Well, I don't know about the status of being, honestly. He doesn't talk about that here.
I guess you're just too finite, Wes.
I think he may be talking about it implicitly in the sense of speaking of the past and the future not existing. So therefore, they don't have being.
Well, that part, yes, mm-hmm. but the present is confusing because it has no duration. So does it have being? You know, it's the point which has no part problem, and I wouldn't know what to do with it.
Well, does he know what to do with it? What is his solution?
I didn't see him talk about that, did he?
Does he come up with a conclusion? One of the conclusions I have from chapter 12 is eternity can't be a time period at all. That you think about eternity as just like the longest time period.
Right, it's not.
Eternity won't be a time period, right?
Eternity is the atemporal position.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. It has and no so, part. Eternity is the point.
And a corollary of that is no time is co-eternal with God.
Right.
Maybe this is all just a roundabout way of, remember I introduced the time section by, oh, the Manichaean asked me, well, what did God do before he created stuff? So he's just explaining why that is all misconceived, even though he probably didn't need a 30-page digression to show that.
It's consistent with other things he's done in that he takes a question that seems to be a paradox and shows how, in thinking it through, he can make it understandable. Earlier on in the first sections we read, he points to his understanding of what evil really is being a watershed moment for him intellectually, because he was able to resolve the conflict that there was God, the one purely good entity in the universe, actually created evil. And the Manichaean position was that both things were in the world and that God was good, but there was also evil in the world that was against God and not created by God. And he found that utterly inconsistent and figured his way out of it by coming up with a different understanding of what evil was. And I think the same kind of thinking is going on here with time, going through the hermeneutic of what time is to overthrow what appears to be a paradox and show that it's not really a paradox, but along the way, inventing a notion of how to understand time.
Sounds good. Really, we've looped back to where we started the conversation in terms of, is time the motion of bodies? No.
Yeah, we don't need to go over that again.
Any final point or two from the text from near the end of this?
There are no more points. It's pointless.
Measured time does not exist objectively. The past devours the future.
In the end, it just looks like time is, yeah, as you pointed out, Mark, before, part of the imagination. It looks very Kantian, even though there's this talk of the present existing. Because he goes on to talk about the past and the future. Sort of looks like they exist only in the mind, and the present is a fleeting moment. And a moment isn't something that we experience, right? Even the smallest amount of experience for us has a duration that could be divided.
Well, it's always a motion, right? We never experience a moment because we always experience it in terms of motion. We can't experience time as a moment without experiencing the ends of it. And therefore, we interpolate the moment by understanding the motions that bound it.
Also, a moment just, it doesn't contain enough data for experience.
We experience things in terms of differences. We never experience them in themselves. To the extent that we experience them in terms of differences, we have to have at least two of them in order to be able to have a difference and therefore have duration. And we will not have a point out of that. We will not have a moment out of that. It will always be a duration.
Yeah. So experience requires objects, and objects require a sequence of
yes.
perspectival snapshots that are held together within the mind. And so this fleeting, partless present isn't even something that we can experience. It's a hypothetical. What we think of as the briefest moment is actually quite extended in duration.
Well, what you and I have had together, my friends, we will always have this duration. But next time, in the next duration, we will read F.A. Hayek's The Use of Knowledge in Society, an article from 1945, and part one of Amartya Sen's On Ethics and Economics from 1987.
Oh my God, are you kidding me?
This is what our guest, who Seth solicited.
So difficult to read.
That's what's happening. Just to make us feel like Augustine was a more pleasurable experience.
Are we going to grind some glass into our eyeballs and squirt lemon juice into it too? Actually, Augustine wasn't that bad.
Yes, let us, in the what little energy we have left of this evening, give some final reflections on our experience with this continued duration with our friend, St. Augustine of Hippo.
I say read Augustine, but feel free to fast forward through certain sections.
Yeah.
Certain parts of it are very interesting, and he's not a bad writer, but some of the confessional aspect of it gets, for me, insufferable.
Yeah.
I have to just fast forward.
Yep, agreed.
By the end of this, on my second listen through, and again, there are parts of this reading that I actually read in the book, but still the majority of it I listened to again on LibriVox, and it's just that I would stop a lot and dictate a note into an email for myself. So I'm walking around listening at double speed to somebody reading Augustine and then stopping it and then reading a sentence like, "He that speaks a lie speaks out of himself. Gift is what is perceived. The fruit is the goodwill of the giver." And then proceeding on my way, looking like an idiot as I'm walking the dog. So doing that for the second time, even with book 13 that I thought was just completely lacking in any content the first time I listened to it. And it has 38 chapters, so it's like not an insignificant piece of nothing. Even that I felt was a little satisfying on the second listen through, that I was getting that old time philosopher's like, he's got a well-polished system here. It may have things that are ultimately unsupported, but at least it's really goddamn consistent and rich, and a smart person could think this, even though it should all be consigned to the flames because it's not about the things of the senses or mathematics, as Hume would say. So let's erase this episode. Consign it to the flames. Hey, everybody, remember the after show. We're going to do another after show. We didn't do one last time. This is going to cover both of the Augustine episodes. It's going to be on Sunday, September 6th, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Central Time. PEL citizens should go sign up to attend it. Everybody should watch it, either live as it happens or after the fact on YouTube. Get details at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thanks to all the people that have given us money because they want us to do more Augustine. So let's just do the City of God. Let's do this 5-volume.
I saw that on the bookshelf at the bookstore, and I went running away.
I won't be partaking of any more of this. So.
It's not even 5 volumes. I was just imagining 5 volumes.
Spiritual bounty.
It was in like a Penguin paperback. It was a good 3.5 inches thick.
Well, maybe somebody can start a not school group on that. They should do that.
They should publish editions in which the flowery bullshit is in like red ink, and the rest of it's in black ink.
Some authors need to have had editors.
Yes. And it sounds sacrilegious and uncharitable, but unless you're religious,
it's true.
Unless you're a religious person or a religious person of that time or of a different century, it's not just the amount of delay and padding with the "Oh God" and all that. It's the sort of hysterical, abject, masochistic nature of it that makes me feel violent towards Augustine. Like, this makes me hate him. But the parts where he's saying things are fantastic.
I just got around earlier today to doing a search among podcasts for things on the Confessions. And I don't know what it was offhand, but there's some kind of theological seminary that has a lecture, like a good 45-minute lecture on each book up through book 9. And so I listened to a couple of them, and they're basically sermons. So I think this is great fodder for religious folks, for including the latter books, for just the purpose it was intended for, of contemplating the glory of God and how you too can resist temptation and be one with God. And it's just, if you want to actually do philosophy, then maybe that's not so useful.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys, for sticking it out. No thanks for Seth.
Seriously.
I think he's probably one with God at this point. All right, fellas. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
The past is not the past is not the past is not real. The past is not the past is not the past is not real. I don't remember, I wasn't there. It was nothing, I couldn't care. The past is not the past, it's the past is, oh God. Just keep telling yourself. The past is not the past, it's not the past, it's not real.
past is not the past, it's not the past, it's not the way it makes you feel. We're all here now, just in the present, except, oh God, what the hell happened? Except these things, these facts, taking them as given as persistent, done but here with interest to someone who once thought of you as good. The past is not the best, is not the best, is not real. The past is not the best, is not the best, is not real. The past is not the best, is not the best, is not real. The past is not the best, is will it not real? The past is not the best, is not the best. I don't remember. I've no idea. You cannot hate me. I wanna fear. In a long, cold chapter of a fictional drawing of a year long winter, melting all the last straw. The best is not the best, is not the best, is not, it's not real. The best is not the best, is not the best, is not, it's not really something.
Should happen according to the law of averages.